Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
Someone sent me the link to Malachy's this match report that Malachy had written. And I remember the two of us sitting at the bar, you know, the side bar in Neary's. I remember the two of us just sitting at the bar silently, just reading it. And then just going, oh, this is so good. And then reading it again.
Welcome all, it's the 43rd episode of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is Kieran Murphy of Second Captains, and we'll get to the chat in just a second. But a quick reminder that you can, of course, get in touch with us here at the show. Email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm at gcooney93. Or you can, of course, join the members' WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. But it is now time to get on with said podcast episode with Kieran Murphy. Hey, Kieran, thank you so much for doing the show.
No problem at all, Gavin. Thanks for asking me.
Were you always going to go into broadcasting? Or was there, or is there a road not travelled?
Yeah, it was always journalism. To be honest, Gavin, and I remember being asked when I was seven what I wanted to be, you know, seven or eight, and the answer was always a sports journalist, you know. And I know that's kind of a very privileged position to be in, you know. But like my uncle is Jim Carney, who's the presenter of the Sunday Game, who's kind of an impossibly glamorous character in my upbringing. And whether it was just I want to kind of be like Jim, or whether there was something about the job that I knew I would really enjoy even at seven or eight, I think it's quite hard to separate those. But no, I always kind of wanted to be a sports journalist, and kind of watching Jim be a commentator. He presented the Sunday Game kind of in the late 70s and early 80s, but he was a commentator kind of throughout the 1990s as well, which is when I would have kind of grown up watching him and, you know, going to games with him, and kind of you know, just seeing like how people react to him and the respect that people had for him. It was just a very very glamorous and a very appealing sort of an existence. And I know obviously sports journalism is rather different than that the reality.
I was going to say, I'm afraid like the people falling at your Uncle Jim's feet might have given you kind of a false impression of the existence for 99% of the rest of us.
Yeah. No, it's, well, I suppose 99% of us aren't like Jim Carrey either, to be honest, yeah. if I can be boastful on his behalf. But he... it crazy, you know. So I would have... That was kind of the glamorous end of it. And then kind of as I moved kind of through my early teens, Jim's brother Noel, he's also a very good journalist, he would have done match reports for the Tume Herald and the Connacht Tribune and places like that. And we had a computer and he didn't. So he roped me in to typing out his kind of written out match reports as a kind of 12 and 13 year old. So that I could email them into the respective newsrooms. And so kind of like every Sunday evening, kind of from when I was probably 11 or 12 right through till I was probably 16, 17, 18, maybe not 18, but God, maybe 18 as well. He would have come up to our house with kind of four or five written out sheets of newspaper where he'd have like the match reports for the two hurling matches that he'd have been at, or football matches that he, you know, club games that he'd have been at that day for the local newspapers. And that was an unbelievable grounding for me in what, like, just the nuts and bolts of how to report on a match. And Noel was just a really good straight down the line a proper journalist. And so, you know, very quickly you see how you put a match report together. And so as I was doing that for Noel, I could see, you know, what people were looking for in a match report, because Noel kept giving it to them. Every word he wrote was just so clear and concise and to the point. And it, like, you know, Jim was kind of like this huge influence, but I kind of gloss over, when people ask me about this, I always kind of gloss over that part. And that part, the more I think about it, is actually was, you know, that was just hitting me over the head all the time. There is a right way to do this. And Noel just kept doing it. So kind of from, I think I was like 13 or 14, and Jim would have known that, you know, obviously this was kind of a big thing for me and, or, a, you know, a big ambition of mine, and to go into sports journalism. So I ended up kind of doing match reports for local newspapers. I think, you know, once I was finished first year in secondary school, so maybe 13 or 14, and like that was just a natural progression for me because, you know, Jim would have given me very clear guidelines on what he wanted. Noel wrote in such a clear way that I knew the job even at that stage, you know, like, and I made a million mistakes and, you know, I wasn't anywhere near kind of their level, but I knew the job just from the grounding that like both of my uncles were able to give me. And so, you know, so from kind of that first summer of secondary school onward, I was just doing match reports for the Tume Herald and the Connacht Tribune and Galway Bay FM. But really, it was print journalism. I remember doing my first kind of match report for Galway Bay FM and just being really stressed out by it and not enjoying it at all. And kind of that never really left me when it, as far as the radio work was concerned. But I loved the print journalism. So it was always print journalism for me. And then when I did an undergrad in NUI Galway in arts, and then I did the master's in DCU. And how I got into News Talk was actually I was looking for placements that included sport, and I think the only one or one of two that were available that year were in News Talk, and myself and Mark Horgan both went for it, and we both got taken on in News Talk. So I started my work placement in News Talk in, I think, the mid-July 2004. Myself and Mark started the same day, having been good old buddies in college for the year before, and kind of it kind of took off from there.
So, like, you went to university, landed you in News Talk, you worked in Off the Ball for many, many years, and then you all made the decision to leave. Was it scary the day you all walked out together?
Yeah, probably. It's like scary is a word, all right. Yeah. Now the day itself was, you know, the culmination of a lot of days. Mm. Probably, you know, 8 or 9 months of us kind of talking about what we'd like to do next for the station and within the station. And so, you know, when the time came, you know, it was just the culmination of something. And really, I think the big thing that we were sure of at that stage was that, you know, having done the show for, that was 9 years. So I did July 2004 to March of 2013. So, you know, pretty much 9 years. And, you know, at that stage, you know, having done it for 9 years, having worked, you know, till 10 o'clock or half 10 every single night, you know, which is just, you know, you can do it when you're 23 or 24, no problem. But when we were all into our 30s at that stage, and, you know, you can't keep doing that, you know, for your own sanity and for your own kind of well-being. So the one thing we were sure of on that day was that we didn't want to work in News Talk anymore. And kind of once you know that, then, you know, the rest of it you can kind of handle, you know. And that was kind of, that was the big thing from our perspective, you know. And it's, you know, obviously mad that you know, there wasn't like an exit plan, you know, like a carefully choreographed here are our next steps or anything like, but we just didn't want to work at News Talk anymore. That was kind of that once you have that decision made, every other decision kind of flows from that. And kind of, you know, kind of within a couple of days of us kind of hanging out in Mark's house and watching a couple of DVDs and avoiding phone calls and, you know, all sorts of kind of mad and stressful but kind of fun days as well, you know. Yeah. Maybe they weren't that much fun, to be honest. Maybe I'm only remembering it as fun. But you know, we started work on the RT2 had shown an interest in doing some TV work with us kind of pretty soon after that, and we were doing podcasts for the Irish Times by, I think, the end of May that that year. So, you know, it wasn't like there was, you know, 6 months of inaction. It actually, things happened pretty fast after that. We were, you know, we had the first series of our television show in September of 2013. So, you know, these things, it all happened quite fast in a weird kind of way. But I mean, for sure, like, I do remember, you know, getting a text message, you know, and we're like, we just didn't want to talk on that day, to bring it back to that actual Monday morning where we were, when it became clear we weren't going to be doing the show anymore. You know, we were all in Mark's house kind of hanging around, and we just didn't want to say anything. And, you know, like, what's the point? You know what I mean? It's all kind of done and dusted. But I do remember getting a text message from Conor Pope in the Irish Times, who had been trying to kind of get a statement from us or whatever. I think we released something or anyway, but I do remember him texting me at like 10 o'clock that night saying, you might be interested to know that you're going to be on the front page of the Irish Times tomorrow, you know, that the story of us leaving. And, like, you know, there's obviously a healthy dose of, you know, media people being very interested in a media story, and, you know, being on the front page of a newspaper doesn't necessarily mean that equates to what the public are interested in all the time. But at the same time, like, that was kind of crazy.
Yeah. I won't linger on it for too long, and you're probably sick talking about it, but, like, the reaction was crazy. And I remember you weren't known as second captain then. You were the OTB5, if I'm remembering that correctly.
Yeah, well, it's funnily enough, actually, when we were setting up our Twitter account, we made a decision. Mark made a decision that we didn't want the Twitter account to be just off the ball, you know, and that's like kind of maybe, I don't know when we joined Twitter, but that's probably an indication that even then there was an idea in our heads that, you know, the five of us were going to stick together, you know, that there was a working relationship there that was worth pursuing regardless of kind of where we would be for the duration of that. So our Twitter account, funnily enough, was always at Second Captains, even when we were doing Off the Ball.
Right.
And, you know, yeah. So that's, you know, that's a sort of a detail that maybe only, you know, only we remember. But yeah, no, so that was kind of always in our heads, you know, there is a certain way that we do things that we'd like to hold on to regardless of kind of where we were working or whatever.
Yeah, and there were people, if I'm right, refusing to go on the show, that first show that you left, the afternoon you left, because obviously you started to put on a show in your absence, and there were people refusing to go on. Like, did you feel awkward in that scenario, or like, was it a bit overwhelming?
You know, people are going to make their own decisions, you know, and like, I would have had a couple of phone conversations even like over the course of that week with people that we would have worked with, and they were just like, well, you know, I just enjoy doing radio and I'm just going to keep doing it. And like, you absolutely respect that, you know what I mean? Like, that's just the reality, you know. You know, it's not like we were a particularly solid bet to go banking on. You know, if you wanted to keep, you know, like, who knows? I mean, if they asked me where we were going to go next, we didn't have an answer, you know. So, you know, you just kind of roll with the punches, really, you know. Like, there might have been a bit of that going on, but, you know, like, that's kind of people's own personal decisions. I wouldn't hold that against anyone, you know.
And Record Scratch, 7 years on, you are one of the biggest podcasts on Patreon in the world. You're getting rave reviews now with the BBC series Where's George Gibney. Like, did you think it would work out this well?
Yeah, but again, like, it's kind of, you know, back in 2013, we probably had to educate ourselves a little as to what a podcast was. You know what I mean? Like, I think that, like, Serial was either out at that stage or was just coming out. And, you know, like, the kind of worldwide sensation that Serial was a huge moment for, I think, for just podcasting as a medium, you know? Like, Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant were doing a podcast, I think, in 2008 or something like that. And that had a sort of niche popularity. But, you know, like, you know, we didn't know that was the way we were going to go. I mean, that's how it worked out, and it's worked out brilliantly for us. And to answer your question, like, I don't think any of us would have had any idea of kind of the level of success that we've had, and hopefully we'll continue to have. But again, it's like, you know, it's not you know, that wasn't even a ladder that we were hoping to climb. Do you know what I mean? It's all you can do is kind of just, you know, work with the people that you work with and trust each other and make decisions based on kind of that trust and the experiences that you've had together as a group. And hope that kind of the things that you think are right will continue to be right, you know, or the principles or, you know, sort of the guiding lights of your own career continue to be the, you know, shining in the right way. So that's all you can kind of hope for, you know. And if we'd gone a million different directions, or, you know, there are a million decisions you make in those 7 years that, you know, could go one way or the other. And we've been lucky that, you know, a lot of the times we've made the right decisions at kind of the right moment. And, you know, like, say, even the Patreon model of asking people to pay, you know, €5 plus VAT a month for kind of the full, you know, the full week's broadcasting. I mean, you know, that was a shot in the dark as well, you know. And you know, we did our homework as best we could, and you know, we asked all the people that we could ask whether this was a right idea. But at the end of the day, it hadn't been done before, so in Ireland, so you have to just trust yourself and trust the listeners that have obviously stuck with us, for some of them for many, many years, more of them are just finding out about us courtesy of the George Gibney podcast. But you just got to trust that those guys will stick with you, those people will stick with you. So yeah, it's kind of you know, it's hard to ascribe, you know, a set plan or a, you know, like an ambition or where do we want to be in 5 years time. Like, really, who knows, you know? Like, you don't have a clue. All I would say is that, you know, I enjoy so much working with my co-workers that I could be doing anything with those people, and as long as I was doing with those guys, I think I'd be happy enough, you know. So it's been obviously like such a laugh. The whole thing has been just so much fun. I think that's kind of the key thing. I've had such fun doing it, and such fun working with the people that I've worked with, that you just kind of you thank your lucky stars, really, don't you, for that?
Yeah. Now, can I hold my hand up and say that shamefully I've not actually listened to the George Gibney podcast yet. I have a strange compulsion where I want to rack up a few episodes so I can binge it in one go. I don't know if anyone else is like that, but that's how I'm kind of approaching it. But tell us, for anyone who is unaware of the podcast, Kieran, can you tell us a little bit about it, and why you've decided to do this story and in this format?
Right. Well, I mean, we did a show on the George Gibney case a couple of years ago. It was just like one show. With Justine McCarthy, who's the author of Deep Deception, and which is just kind of the story of the swimming scandals of the early 90s in Ireland, and a brilliant, shocking, horrible book. But it was kind of on the back of the Larry Nassar US gymnastics story that broke in 2018, and the Barry Bunnell, the football coach who was found guilty of sexually abusing players in his care, that, you know, like, we did that show with Justine McCarthy on the back of those kind of two scandals. And really, it was a case of Mark really thinking that there was a bigger story here than just one podcast. And kind of from then, you know, it's been very much Mark's baby. Mark was I think just really taken and really appalled by the idea that George Gibney had managed to escape even a standing trial for what he had done. And, you know, what really struck people watching the Larry Nassar and the Barry Bunnell cases unfold was that their victims got their moment in court, you know, that they got the chance to stand up and look their abuser in the eye and say that they'd moved on with their lives, that they'd survived, and that, you know, that the abuser would be sent to jail by the survivors, by their victims. And that's not something that's been able to happen yet for the people, the victims of George Gibney. And, you know, Mark kind of took it on from there, I mean, it's an extraordinary piece of work. He worked on it with his sister Maria, with Killian Down, who works with us as a researcher on Second Captains now as well. He joined Second Captains to work as a researcher originally on the George Gibney podcast, and also with Kieran Cassidy, who was also in our journalism class in DCU. So we know Cass, for myself and Mark do, for 17 years, and Ken actually knew him when Cass was in Trinity as well. And Kieran is an extraordinarily gifted filmmaker, has done a ton of documentary on one docs with RT Radio, I'd be really interested to hear what you think of them when you do sit down to listen to them. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of people probably who want to build up a little kind of cache of them and have a listen to three or four of them. But honestly, I, having been sent them kind of in dribs and drabs, I actually can only listen to one at a time because, you know, the strength of the survivors, the episode that was released last week, had interviews with Burke Harley and Trish Kearney, and just the power of their testimony is, yeah, I don't know that it's something you can binge. I'll be interested to hear what you make of it, but to be honest, my involvement in it was so little that I can't actually say that I think it's an extraordinary piece of work, and for it to not be boastful in any way, because this has very much been Mark and Kieran and Killian and Maria's baby, and myself and Owen have listened to a couple of episodes and have thrown in our tuppence from time to time during the course of the production. But honestly, we've had zero influence on how it's gone down. And so yeah, I can say that it is extraordinary. There are two have been released as we record. There's another six to come out, and then a further two, which will be released kind of before the end of the year, to try and bring the entire story bang up to date. Having listened to, I think, all the way up to episode six, episode seven, there's plenty more to come, and it's extraordinary. Yeah.
So you'll find it on BBC Sounds app, or indeed whatever app you get your podcasts on. Okay, Kieran, let's tear into some of these picks. First up, Silence by Roger Angel. We think it's Angel rather than Angel, but obviously there's a New Yorker fact checker listening that will double check that or correct us on that if we're wrong.
Yes.
Tell us about this piece and why you picked it.
Okay, well, I found this piece originally in the Picador Book of Sports Writing, which is a compilation of sports writing, which I gave away many moons ago to a friend. I don't know who I gave it to. It was never returned to me. So if the culprit is listening, I'd like that back, please. But it's an absolutely brilliant piece. And I remember loving it the first time I read it, and it became a lot more relevant in 2020 because basically, it's about the baseball strike in 1981, and the author is in a cab going home through the streets of New York at around midnight, and the cab driver has the radio on, the news is read out, and he's waiting for the sports results to be read, and he's waiting for the baseball scores to be read out. And it's at that moment, I think it was like a week into the strike, and it was at this moment, after he'd had a couple of glasses of wine, and he's having like your kind of stereotypical New York cab ride through kind of, you know, post-midnight New York, and he suddenly realizes what's missing. The silence of the title of the piece is the fact that there are no baseball scores being read out. And basically, it's the idea that I think we all kind of tried to get to grips with this year, which is that, and for me, you know, like the kind of, I grew up very much in a GA household, and it's, the GAs, it's not just a summer thing in our house. Like, you know, we talk more often probably about sort of club football, our club at home, Milltown, or the club that I'm playing for now, Temple Oak King Street up in Dublin. It's entirely year round. Like, my brother has a kid playing for the Athenry under 14s. Like, you know, this stuff it's year round. But at the same time, there is something about an Irish summer without the intercounty GAA championships, which just seems just completely wrong, you know? Like I was on holidays in North Mayo this year for a couple of days, and to not have the back and forth that you'd have with, you know, 30 different people in Mayo over the course of a 3-day stay about, you know, whether this is going to be their year or not or whatever. And I love that idea of sport being, you know, as reliable as a calendar when it comes to what you're talking about. So, you know, if it's February and March, it's the Six Nations. If it's May, it's the end of the Premier League and the Champions League final. If it's, you know, June and July, once every 4 years, it's the World Cup. If it's August and September, it's the GAA All-Ireland semi-finals and finals, and the non-stop chatter that is on, that's everywhere when it comes to these big games. And being robbed of it this year was kind of, you know, say all of my family now live in Galway, so when Galway come up and play in Croke Park, whether that's hurling or football, it's also a family reunion for us, you know. So, you know, there would often be kind of 7 or 8 of us at a Galway game between nephews and nieces and brothers and mam and dad. And so the whole thing is a family reunion, you know. And then summer comes and it's, you don't get that, you know, like you have to go home, but it's an entirely different thing, you know. And we realize kind of in the back of it all that this stuff kind of binds us all together and gets us together and gets us excited together. And this piece is just, it's a really, really evocative of that idea of, you know, what would it be like without sport, you know? And you would miss the All-Ireland semi-finals or finals with 80,000 people, but you'd also just miss the murmur, just the low murmur of it all in your life, which is, you know, as impactful in its ways as missing out on All-Ireland finals.
Well,
you know?
There's nothing else to talk about. I mean, yeah. I've realised that maybe I need to widen my kind of cultural palate, but I mean, there was months there where there's nothing to talk about other than, Jesus, you know, God, this pandemic thing is surreal. And then empty conversation after that. There is also, there's a lovely, so my favourite bit of this piece is buried in the middle of it. He mentions, it might even be better for me to do without baseball for a while, although I could not imagine why. And then he describes it as all this brave nonsense was knocked out of me in an instant. And I totally agree with that, because now look, when I go back through my old tweets, I cringe most of the time, but I'm going back to like April time, in the middle of the height of the pandemic, and I've got all this arch stuff like, there is no moral justification for playing Premier League football in the middle of a pandemic. And then it came back and I'm thinking, what a crock of shit that was. I mean, it's really important to play it.
Yeah, it is, you know. And it's, you know, it's the most important of the unimportant things. I've mangled that quote, but, you know, that's what it is. And it's kind of, you know, you would have read plenty of pieces kind of sort of outlining just how important sport is to people and kind of what they miss about it. And, you know, they would have focused on those big games. But like the part of this piece that I love is that piece you've just mentioned, and the sort of the couple of lines after that. The refrain of late night baseball scores, the sounds of the televised game from the next room, the room empty perhaps for the moment, but the game running along in there just the same and quietly waiting for us to step in and rejoin it when we are of a mind to. The mid-game, mid-event from some car or cab that pulls up beside us for a few seconds in traffic before the light changes. The baseball conversation in the elevator that goes away when two men get off together at the 11th floor, taking the game with them. And, like, that's just, like, that's what it's all about, you know? Like, it's not like I live for, you know, cringy conversations in a spare in Ballina, you know, as, you know, like the highlight of my summer holidays. But at the same time, it's a part of it as much as, you know, as any other part of a holiday, is to actually sit and talk to a complete stranger for 30 seconds about the game that had been on the previous weekend or the fortunes of the county team that you're in. Like that, you know, it's the ways big and small that you've find yourself immersed in sport that I just kind of loved about this piece. And I mean, it is, it's like, you know, as he says kind of in the final paragraph, you know, it's like that idea of people who live by the river. It's like there's some stat about, you know, people who live by the Niagara Falls can't sleep anywhere else because the noise of the Niagara Falls is so a part of them that they can't sleep without it. Yeah. Whenever they go, you know, and like, I think that that's what it is, you know, like that's what sport can be for people. And what it certainly is for us, you know, that it's just this thing that, you know, it's like, you know, breathing, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's, you know, or beef burgers or, you know, it's like, you know, it's something that you just absolutely take for granted. And then when it's gone, it's chaos.
Yeah,
you know?
It's so, the piece is so well written as well. Like, it flows so well. I did the slightly wanky thing of reading this out loud, but it I really enjoyed doing it because it reads so well. Yeah. Roger Angel, like, as far as I'm aware, he's still alive. I think he might be hitting 100 at this point, but David Remnick is his editor, who, like, listeners to this show will know, who wrote the great book on Muhammad Ali. In terms, he's written a good bit about sport and Mike Tyson and boxing.
But King Ali, of the World. Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Yeah,
that's been mentioned, and there's a very good, actually, I'd recommend it to listeners. There's a The Only Game in Town, I think it's called. It's like a compilation of sports writing from the New Yorker, and Remnick begins his introduction by talking about Roger Angel, and he kind of reveres him. Basically, he says he's the best writer to ever dedicate himself to sport, and he talks about his sentences having a tensile zing. I'm not 100% sure what a tensile zing is, but I want my sentences to have one.
It's mad, actually. I went looking for a link for this to send on to you, and it won't come up because it's not actually credited to Roger Angel in the original New Yorker that it appears in. It's less than a page long. But I have a New Yorker subscription anyway, so I went looking for it in whatever edition would have been put out in sort of July of 1981. And the intro to it is, we have had a letter about the baseball strike from a friend of ours here in the city. And that's how the article begins. So it's not even credited to Angel in the original New Yorker piece, but it is him, all right. And Remnick as well wrote some brilliant stuff. His reporting, which is a compilation of his stuff for the New Yorker and his time in Russia as well as a journalist, is brilliant. And there's three or four articles in that relating to sport. One about Mike Tyson, which is really, really good. And one about Lennox Lewis as well, I think. But yeah, like, Remnick knows his stuff, all right. So if it comes with the Remnick seal of approval, I'm all for it.
Okay, your next piece. I'll let you credit the author on this one.
So it's by a little known author by the name of Ken Early, who wrote a piece for 8x8 magazine in 2014 on Steven Gerrard. And it was first printed, in a magazine called 8x8, then published in The Guardian, I think, a couple of weeks after that as well. The piece is utterly brilliant because, you know, there are some characters, I think, in your kind of sporting sphere that you kind of presume you know a lot about or you know enough about. And, you know, Gerrard had obviously been, you know, a major player in the Premier League for, you know, nearly for 15 years at that stage. And it just told me so many new things about Steven Gerrard, explained so succinctly, you know, all of the extravagant gifts that he had, as well as all kind of the weaknesses as a leader and as a captain and as a footballer that he had. And, you know, it's just one of those things where if you interviewed Steven Gerrard for a week, you know, if you gave it the full Gate to Leeds treatment, like spent 2 months traveling around with Steven Gerrard, you wouldn't get close to the sort of central truth of Gerrard as a footballer that Ken does in this piece. Because, you know, the entire point of the piece in a lot of ways is that Steven Gerrard has no idea what sort of a footballer he is. That self-awareness is just not a strong point of his at all. I mean, it's, you know, strong point or weakness. I mean, it's not even so much that it's a weakness. It's just he has a blind spot about his abilities as a footballer, and his, you know, there are character flaws within him, weaknesses, personality weaknesses, I suppose, that haven't helped him throughout his career, and yet he has still managed to have had one of the really great club careers of kind of this century. And it was an extraordinary piece at the time. I do remember so many people who knew that Ken was, you know, an excellent writer, messaging me in the sort of the aftermath of that, just going, holy shit, this is an unbelievable piece of work. And there are so many brilliant points in it. But I mean, like, he was played out of position, according to Steven Gerrard, for all of the best years of his career under Rafa Benitez, which is a hell of a coincidence, you'd have to say. You know, the idea that you wouldn't even know your own best position, you know, as a footballer, you know, and to still kind of argue the point that, like, I'm kind of being played out of position, even while you're winning every personal accolade that you could possibly do, you know, come within an ace of winning the league title for your team, and still not really have a clue about what being a great footballer actually means, you know? And, you know, like, it's interesting now to look back and think, Steven Gerrard is a manager with Rangers now, obviously, and you're like, it's kind of hard to see him making a fist of management if he couldn't, you know, if he couldn't turn any sort of a magnifying glass onto his own football career. So I mean, to be honest, I could have picked a lot of the stuff that Ken has written, to be honest, because he is my favorite writer to read, and I think he's an extraordinarily entertaining person to you know, like, there is a belly laugh in pretty much every one of his pieces, I think.
Yeah,
and I think that's the first thing I'd have to say about him, that people are so conditioned to either agree and therefore like a piece, or disagree and therefore hate a piece, that conceiving of a piece that you would disagree with and love is too much for some people, you know? And, like, at the end of the day, this isn't politics. This isn't, you know, what you think is, you know, the very definition of morally right and morally wrong. This is sport, you know? And the idea that you could read something that you disagree with root to tip and enjoy immensely is something that I think Ken is absolutely capable of delivering, maybe better than anyone else at the moment.
Yeah, the Gerrard piece is so good. Like, Gerrard was obsessed with being a central midfielder. And I think, you know, that probably came from, well, as Ken points out in this piece, what Keane and Vieira were for United and Arsenal. And the fact that Liverpool hadn't had one since Graham Souness in the 80s. So, like, the absence of that, what Ken describes midfield general, almost became a displacement for Liverpool's lack of success. You know, they were missing the general.
Yeah.
So therefore, they could not be successful. And Gerrard was obsessed with, you know, taking all of the responsibility on his shoulders, and it eventually broke him. I always thought that he should have left. I mean, he should have left in 2004 when he first threatened to leave. He would have been, I don't know, would he have had a much better career? He probably would have. But I definitely think he would have ended up happier. Like it's pointed out in this pen, in this piece, he's a miserable, miserable man. He's so gloomy,
yeah,
and he's so pessimistic.
Yeah, and even, you know, like, we do not let this slip, you know, like, the just, you know, that moment, you know, we do not let this slip. You know, again, it's like the negativity of it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, power on, win the league. But the immediate idea was, you know, if we make a mistake, it'll be a disaster. We can't make a mistake, you know? And just that idea of you know, the of him fundamentally misunderstanding what it is to be a brilliant footballer, you know. And even, you know, you think back, like, how could you say that a man like Steven Gerrard, you know, I'm the man, I'm the fucking man running to the TV camera, how could you say he was short of self-confidence? Like, that's all part of it as well, you know what I mean? That, like, that was a manifestation of a lack of belief in his own ability, you know, that, like, when it comes to that moment and he starts roaring that at a TV, who's he roaring at? He's probably roaring at himself,
yeah,
you know? And that's, and, like, just the sort of piercing insight that Ken brings to, you know, a person who really, you know, the almost, like, weighed down by his own ability, weighed down by the fact that it's his hometown club. Like, if he leaves, he's just a footballer trying to win trophies somewhere else. But, you know, like, you have to admire the fact that Gerrard stayed, and you have to admire the fact that he did try and do superhuman things to get Liverpool to the top of the mountain,
yeah,
you know? But at the same time, it's, you know, it was kind of destined to end the way it did in a lot of ways for Steven Gerrard.
And the way it ended, like, if it effectively ended with the slip against Chelsea, like, that's a kind of a morality play on the points that are made in this piece, which I think was published probably a few months before before that piece.
Yeah.
Before that slip, should I say. You know, because he slips because he's at the back of midfield where where his best managers realise he shouldn't be. And then he responded by, you know, having 8 or 9 shots from, you know, hopeless angles from distance in the hope that he might single-handedly rescue it. Like, it was the reaction was as bad as the slip. So I think that it was the whole thing was like this kind of tragedy based off everything that had been bubbling to the surface to that point. But
Gerard was never really a general. Deep down, he's always been a star. And like, that was it. You know, like, he was a star. He should have behaved like a star. You know what I mean? If you clowns can't help me win a league, I'm off to Chelsea, you know? But that wasn't what he wanted to do. You know, like, he wanted to be, you know, the one club guy, the general, the Graeme Souness, the Roy Keane, the Patrick Vieira. And, you know, like the amount of years he spent kind of pouring himself into that role when really that's not what he was. He was a scorer of spectacular goals, a player who could do unbelievable things. That's who he was. He wasn't, you know, Claude Makélélé, you know. Yeah. But it's a brilliant piece.
Oh, no, it's so good. Okay, pick number 3, piece from the Irish Times, a report from All-Ireland Hurling semi-final between Galway and Tipperary, written by friend of the show, Malachy Clerkin. I can guess one of the reasons why you picked this, Ciarán, but are there any others?
To be honest, it's more, I think, an homage to people who can churn out brilliant match reports, you know, within a matter of hours or within a matter of minutes of the end of football matches, hurling matches, whatever it may be. And I know that Jonathan Lewis, you know, various efforts over the course of, you know, the Liverpool 4, Barcelona.
Yeah, we've had to ban that from the show. It's because it's recommended every 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I can absolutely understand why it would be, particularly by people who've been in that position because they understand just how hard it is. I picked this one in ways a slightly different reason. And obviously, I'm from Galway. As I was talking about earlier, my entire family were at this game. And on the Zoom calls, you know, the pandemic Zoom calls, we were talking about our favourite days in Crow Park, and this one was absolutely up there with the 1998 All-Ireland football final as everyone's favourite day. And, you know, I think that speaks to, you know, a couple of different things. And a lot of it is, you know, hero worship. You know, and we were talking about Steven Gerrard, and you're talking about Liverpool fans of a certain age who will never pick anyone else other than Steven Gerrard probably as their favourite Liverpool player just because he did heroic things. And, you know, Joe Canning has done, obviously, many, many heroic things for Galway over the years. And this is kind of, you know, this is the apogee of, you know, of anyone's career. To score, a miracle point from the sideline in the 3rd minute of injury time to beat your most hated rivals. You know, like, it's you know, Roy the Rover stuff. And in situations like that, you know, like, I always want Joe to be the guy that scores the winning point in the 3rd minute of injury time, you know, because people love their heroes and they love, you know, people burnishing their own legend and all the rest of that. But I do remember just that day, just like being in this unbelievable sort of happy glow with my parents, with my brothers for hours afterwards. And my brother John and I, we meet up in the Hogan Stand pub across the road from Crow Park for a couple of drinks, me and my family, after all these Galway games. But myself and John were chasing the high a little that evening, and we went into Neary's in town, just off Grafton Street. And we were sitting there, and both of our wives came in, and myself, people kept joining us, and myself and John kept kind of wandering away to just the two of us talk about just what a brilliant day it was and how brilliant Joe Canning was and what a brilliant point it was. And I remember at like 7:30, someone sent me the link to Malachy's, this match report that Malachy had written. And I remember the two of us sitting at the bar, you know, the side bar in Neary's. So you go into the right to the main bar, and then there's like a little room there into the left. I remember the two of us just sitting at the bar silently, just reading it, and then just going, oh, this is so good. And then reading it again. and like, you kind of have to ask yourself, like, like we were there, like we saw the point. We were actually in the Cusack stand directly behind it. We had the best view of, you know, that you could imagine of the winning score. And like, what is it that you want to read? You know, and obviously Malachy is an exceptional writer, and there are exceptional moments in this match report. But it's like, you've lived it. You're going to watch the Sunday game. You have the game taped at home. You can watch it as often as you like. What is it about a match report that captures it in a different way that's also every bit as satisfying as watching the highlights of the game or the 30-second clip on YouTube or the GA tweet about it or whatever? You know, like why is a match report in and of itself a really satisfying way to relive a moment, you know? And like I just think there is something satisfying about that. Like, there is a reason why we still keep the newspapers after your county's won an Ireland final or something. You know, you buy all the newspapers on the Monday morning and you keep the newspapers. Like, there's something about sitting down and reading it that takes in the full gamut of the game, not just the 30-second highlights or the 15-minute highlights. And, you know, it's people smarter than you describing the action in as breathless a fashion as you remember it. And I think that's why I love this piece. That's why, actually, when you asked me to do this podcast, this was the first piece that popped into my head.
A replay beckoned, tick, 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 but there was no show. There was only the Joe show. Another improbably long free fell on the tip square, and when Cohen gathered the clearance outer end midfield, the Galway midfielder had the presence of mind to pause and see if there was anyone on his shoulder. He must have smiled when he saw Canning looming up. A flick pass, a strike, and the place went into orbit. Galway go to another final. Tip go home to another one in a row, and the rest of us go and lie down.
Yeah. Like the moment itself, like I remember the moment so well, and that's not necessarily because I watch the clip once every 3 weeks. But you know, like, Johnny Cohen is not a person you would put a lot of money on hitting a last minute winner, you know? And just the idea of him like sort of gambling down the Cusack stand sideline and then immediately stopping, immediately going, This is not my moment, you know, this angle is not for mortals, you know? And then for him to turn around and just like, can you imagine the relief? Like, you know, like Malachy says he must have been smiling. Like, but can you imagine the relief? It's like, it's Joe. Just give Joe the ball and over she goes, you know? But it's just like, it's just such a beautifully succinct way, you know, like as he describes, like when the music stops, like that's basically what I'd been at the two previous semifinals, the two previous years. So Galway and Tipperary played 3 years in a row in all Ireland semifinals, and a point separated them on all three occasions. Galway 1-2, Tip 1-1, and like that's all it was, you know, that it was, there was never a definitively better team on any of those three games. It's just when the final whistle went, which one of the two of them were ahead. And, you know, on this occasion, it was Galway. And, like, Bubbles O'Dwyer actually had a wide directly after that. So it wasn't actually as if it was the last puck of the game. In ways, it kind of deserved to be the last puck of the game, but Tip actually did have a chance to equalise. It went wide, and Galway were in the All-Ireland final.
I had totally erased the Bubbles free from my mind. I assume,
yeah,
the way I
it was from play, yeah, it was from play, but it was, yeah, it was like in underneath the Hogan stand, and it was like an exceedingly difficult chance.
Ah, right.
But yeah, there is a moment in the clip where Canning hits it. The camera pans to the crowd, and there's just this owl fella from Galway sitting beside this owl lad from Tipperary, and the two of them shake hands afterwards, and it's just the most. It's just such a pure moment, like, you know, and you can imagine the two of them like passive aggressively, you know, needling each other for the entire game, and then right at the very end, Joe comes up with a moment that good that it's just, yeah, actually, fair is fair, you know, you deserve, Galway deserve it on the back of that one moment alone. So there's a lot tied up in that,
yeah.
And again, it's like, you know, I am probably just too wistful about not having those, you know, the days of summer that we are so used to in 2020 this year, that I'm wistful for that idea of sitting in a pub at 7:30 or 8:00 and Malachy's verdict is in, or Keith Duggan's verdict is in, and you get the chance to relive it all over again for that kind of, for the 2 or 3 minutes it takes you to read through the sort of the minute by minute, the blow by blow account that goes up on the website after, you know, 2 or 3 hours after the final whistle. But that one in particular just really sticks with me.
Yeah. My other memory, I was watching it on the telly, and I do remember the RT commentator calling the tip goalkeeper Brendan Gleeson as he hacked the ball out.
Yeah, I'm always prepared to give him a little bit of leeway. I mean, it was whatever it was, 21 points to 118. Yeah. There was a lot going on at that stage. I'm prepared to give him a pass.
I'm being too cynical and too harsh on him there. I've not named him, in fairness. Ciarán, there are a couple of other picks here. We don't have too much time, but tell us where you want to go next.
Yeah, well, there was one book that I wanted to mention, actually, and that's The Bogeyman by George Plimpton. And this is the third in the series, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners would have already heard of Paper Line and Out of My League, which is this kind of his participatory journalism. He did a few other pieces in Sports Illustrated. He went 3 rounds with Archie Moore, the world champ. And he also played percussion with the New York Philharmonic, which I actually didn't know as well. Played tennis against Pancho Gonzalez. So, you know, it was a bit of a shtick by the time The Bogeyman came around. But the idea was that he would join the US, the PGA Tour, for 3 tournaments that had a kind of a pro-am element. And the book is really funny. There's like, you know, there's a laugh on every page. It's like, it's not as well known as Paperline and Out of My League, because it's not as good as either of those. But my brother did bring me back a first edition copy of this from Rochester, New York, when he was over there filming his first feature length documentary. And he came back with this and Unboxing by Joyce Carol Oates. And the books themselves are beautiful, and I've kind of felt like I should pick a book, because, you know, the idea of giving a book as a gift is something really, really powerful to me. And I love the fact that there's an inscription in this for JDW 1975, love, deed and all, Thanksgiving 1982. And I just love the idea that this was picked up at a secondhand bookshop in Rochester, New York, and here it is in Chicor. But Plimpton describes his the very first page, as I think it might be the best first 2 pages of a book I've ever read. But he talks about the fact that he's a 18 handicapper. My woes in golf, I felt, have been largely psychological. And he talks about when he's playing well, he's plagued with, you know, small quirks, the odd moment of self-doubt, even when he's playing well. But he goes on to write, when I'm playing badly, far more massive speculation occurs. I often sense, as I commit myself to a golf swing, that my body changes its corporeal status completely and becomes a mechanical entity built of tubes and conduits and boiler rooms here and there with big dials and gauges to check, a Brobdingnagian structure put together by a team of brilliant engineers but manned largely by a dispirited, eccentric group of dissolutes, men with drinking problems who do not see very well and who are plagued by liver complaints. I see myself as a monstrous manned colossus poised high over the golf ball, a spheroid that is barely discernible 14 stories down on its tee. From above, staring through the windows of the eyes, which bulge like great bay porches, is an unsteady group, as I see them, of Japanese navy men, admirals most of them. In their hands they hold ancient and useless voice tubes into which they yell their familiar orders. Eye on the ball, chin steady, left arm stiff, flex the knees, swing from the inside out, follow through, keep the head down. And I have to say, as a 18 and more handicapper, that is literally the best description of a terrible golfer's golf swing that I've ever read. And the rest of the book is like the brilliance of Out of My League and Paper Line is how completely out of place, you know, an Upper East Side New Yorker, you know, editor of the Paris Review is in that situation. Whereas, you know, when he's walking around kind of golf clubs, it's a different thing. You know what I mean? He's much happier, much closer to his kind of his set, his type of people than he was, you know, with baseball players or with American football players. And for that reason, the book, I think, isn't near as well known. But I do, like, for that first page alone, I just love that, that description so much.
Yeah, there is a lot of good writing about bad golf. John Updike wrote quite a bit about golf as well.
and he was at his best when he was talking about his own shortcomings. He does occasionally drift into self-praise, at which point it becomes kind of totally unbearable. But The Bogeyman by George Plimpton, that is a super recommendation, because I had never actually heard of it. Can I admit that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I honestly, I hadn't heard of it either until I was presented with the book all the way back from 1967. So the only other piece I want to mention, and it's of the moment, I suppose, given the fact what's going on in America at the moment with all of the racial tensions, what's happening in the NBA over the last month or so. And I just thought I'd mention it because the piece was an unbelievable eye-opener for me. It's called The Case for Reparations by Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Atlantic. And it's basically about kind of housing in America, and how the story of housing tells the story of endemic, systemic racism in America. And, you know, could there be a person less qualified to talk about this than me? I actually just think it's absolutely people's responsibility to read this and to know this. And I know that there are many people who are hugely sympathetic to the Black Lives Matter movement who will be listening to this. There will be some, I'm sure, who aren't as sympathetic and like to talk about, oh, you know, the numbers of people shot in Chicago every year. And, you know, making ridiculous comparisons between that and the numbers of black men shot by police. And I actually, it's not even a case of, you know, go educate yourself, but I do really think it's people's responsibility to read pieces like this and to know this and to try and internalize it and to try and understand why things are the way they are in America. Like, the idea lingers in people's minds that, like, the black experience in the US is somehow comparable to the experience of immigrant groups like Italian Americans or Irish Americans. When pieces like this that actually show you how the US government has thwarted the idea of black wealth and black prosperity from at every stage of its existence from 1776 onward. And Ta-Nehisi Coates is an extraordinary writer. This piece was my first introduction to his work. He wrote a piece called Donald Trump, the First White President for The Atlantic as well, which is astonishing, absolutely brilliant. But maybe a piece on Trump is, well, would just depress everyone. And then there's also always, of course, the temptation to boil every problem in America down to, you know, a Donald Trump problem. And, you know, it's kind of interesting to talk about racist housing policies in the US when, you know, Trump played his part and got rich on the back of...
That is true.
You know, and was in court in the 1970s for his racist housing policies. But, you know, the people's understanding of racism in America often equates to, you know, sit at the back of the bus, you know, the N-word. But what you're dealing with and what Coates writes about here is post-war America, interwar and then post-war America at the highest governmental level, openly ensuring that their black population would be discriminated against at the most, you know, when it comes down to one of the basic needs of humanity, which is to be able to buy your own house, to be able to be safe in your house.
Which is also how you collect wealth in America. Like, that's how you get rich. Like, it's I mean, it is a sensationally good piece. I read it this afternoon under the guise of work, and obviously learned loads about it. But it just goes to show how, you know, how racism, like, when it had to hang up the whip and when it had to move away from segregation, that it became even more pernicious and even more systemic. And like the case for reparations, he's almost like, it's kind of tragic in a way, this piece, because Ta-Nehisi Coates wants the country to have an adult conversation about reparations and America's past, where Donald Trump is the president. I mean, that's not gonna happen. But it's like, the point is, what I liked most about the piece was it's the final third, which says, like, if we have this conversation about reparations, we'll fully accept our history and we'll be kind of able to move on. Like, quote, "Reparations, by which I mean the full acceptance of our collective biography and its consequences, is the price we must pay to see ourselves squarely. The recovering alcoholic may well have to live with his illness for the rest of his life, but at least he is not living a drunken lie." And I'm reading this in the context of the American sports protests of the last couple of weeks. And I think it goes to show this is kind of reparations as a form of activism. And it goes to show why activism is important, because it confronts those ugly issues that would otherwise be kept hidden.
Yeah, and I think that, and you know, you have to ask yourself, like, you know, we can look at this clearly, we can look at this in an absolutely clear-headed fashion, and then it's like, you know, how many things am I, you know, willfully ignorant of when it comes to our own country? And we, you know, we need to ask ourselves those questions as well. But, you know, like, it does appear blindingly obvious that, you know, that as long as America keeps on denying the truth of its own history, you know, nothing will ever be solved, you know, and like and that's why activism, as you say, but also, you know, like visual, like there's like the hard work of showing up at your, you know, at county hall and at city hall and making sure that people are on, you know, voting registers. But then there's actually also highly visible celebrity activism that has to move the needle, because you're dealing with sort of an entrenched mindset that's been there since, like, you know, since 1619, you know, like the 1619 project that the New York Times came out with last year. That's just like, people just go around debunking this stuff rather than saying, okay, maybe there are two factual errors over the course of this, you know, 70,000 word project, but let's try and confront what the piece is or what the project is actually saying. And, you know, that's never going to happen. It doesn't look like it's ever going to happen. But there was just something about this piece that wasn't, that brought it home to me so much more powerfully than, you know, a description of just how hellish life can be for black people today. It's like, this is the story of the black lived experience, that it just made it one of the most powerful things I've ever read, you know. And it's, you know, you're reminded of that Chris Rock line, you know, where he says he knew he was that he had really met it when he moved into a neighborhood and his neighbors were white dentists. You know, that, like, he knew that he had reached, like, the upper echelons of Hollywood fame when he could live with where the white dentists were living, you know. But yeah, I mean, he wrote a brilliant book a couple of years ago called We Were 8 Years in Power. And there's another one, The World and Me. But I mean, you just, Ta-Nehisi Coates, just absolutely exceptional writer. And yeah, there's, I could have recommended a ton of pieces that he's written, but that one really, really stuck in my mind.
Mm. Good news, Murph. You can now do a bit of name dropping if you really want to, because we've three stock questions which we ask all of our guests.
Okay.
Who has been the most interesting person you've met with work?
Okay. Well, the most interesting person. Well, so a number of months ago, we were in our office in Dublin City Centre, and Mark's sister Sharon was in the office. And now, objectively speaking, Sharon Horgan is the most interesting person I've met through my work, to be honest.
Yeah.
But for the purposes of answering this question, Sharon was in our office, and she had had arranged a meeting with someone for later in the day. So we recorded our podcast that morning. We came down to continue our work. And at around 1 o'clock, I was starting to feel quite peckish. But it turns out the guest in question was Donald Gleeson. So Donald Gleeson was meeting up with Sharon in our office. And this was due to happen at around 1 o'clock. And I eat my lunch at around 1 o'clock. I'm a creature of habit when it comes to lunch. When I was in going into the office every day pre-pandemic, I would have two ham and cheese sandwiches at around between the hours of 1 and 1:30. Donald Gleeson was running late on this particular occasion, and so I kept waiting for the office buzzer to go, and it was 1:45, and I was getting quite hungry. I had temporarily been left in sole charge of the office. Sharon was in a separate room. Other people were elsewhere performing tasks relevant to the Second Captain's Limited. So at 1:45, I was like, I'm just going to make these. I'm not going to eat these really plain, quite country man looking sandwiches in front of Donald Gleeson, but I'm going to make sure to eat them as fast as, you know, humanly possible. And then when Donald comes, I will not be angry. I will not be hangry all will be well. So I make my two sandwiches. I bring them to my desk. I'm sitting down to tuck in. And it's this exact moment after I've taken my first bite from my ham and cheese sandwich that the office buzzer goes. So I run over to the buzzer. I pick up the buzzer. The voice, you know, quite a well-known voice is at the other end. I'm here to meet Sharon Horgan. So that's fine. I buzz him up. My mouth is half full of ham and cheese sandwich. That's fine. But as he's walking up the stairs, I'm like, the sandwiches do look really quite tragic. You know, like there's just something, like it's not like there's any rocket in them or anything. There's, you know, there's not a pickle to the side. It's just, it's the sort of sandwich that a Tipperary hurling supporter packs in his boot on the way to Croke Park.
Is there some unfolded tinfoil beneath them?
Yeah, like there's tinfoil. The tinfoil is involved. So as Donald Gleeson is slowly making his way up the stairs, I decide in my wisdom that I'm just going to hide the ham and cheese sandwiches. But I don't want to have left my post for him to walk into an entirely empty office. So basically, long story short, I hid my ham and cheese sandwiches in the TV cabinet directly behind my desk, just in time for Donald Gleeson's arrival into the office. And you know, at this stage, I'm a little rattled by the fact that, you know, is there some sort of Larry David style way that Donald Gleeson would have to put something in the TV cabinet, open the cabinet and see my ham and cheese wrapped in tinfoil sandwiches, pathetic ham and cheese sandwiches. That didn't happen, but I did just very quickly get him out of the room all the same. So I can't say that he was that interesting while he was in my presence, but it was at least an interesting tete-a-tete I thought I had with Ireland's premier movie star of the moment.
And the important thing about that story, Kieran, is you maintained your dignity throughout its telling.
At all times. I mean, 8 different WhatsApp groups I sent that. Sent a picture of my ham and cheese sandwiches in the... It wasn't even one of those where I was like, you know, no one needs to know about this. I immediately recognized the tragic nature of pretty much all of it. I knew that it didn't reflect well on me, but on we go, Gavin. You know, you got to live your life.
The most interesting place you've been with work, Murph?
Well, we were in Sopot and Gdansk for Euro 2012.
For the greatest sesh of the decade.
Yeah. And we did have a great time. And to give you a short answer, because I've been rambling on about Donald Gleeson and my ham and cheese sandwiches. Myself and Owen McDevitt went to the Solidarnosc Museum in Gdansk by the shipyards where Lech Walesa started the Solidarnosc movement. Mm. I'm going to say that was the most interesting the most interesting place that I've been with work. Because, I mean, I'm very much a, you know, we send Ken to these World Cups, you know. I mean, like, when it comes to work, we've been to New York, we've been to San Francisco, we've been to London, we've been to Cardiff. But why not? Why not the Solidarnosc Museum with Owen McDevitt? Just because that's how we spent our Saturdays when we weren't drinking with the Irish Euro 2012 fans.
So if you do want to listen back to the archive of this podcast, Kieran, one of the more embarrassing moments is when I asked Jonathan Wilson, who is the most interesting person he's met with work, and he said, mm-hmm. like Walesa.
And right.
And I assumed that was a footballer, not knowing.
<it's>, you know. Oh, yes. They reached the World Cup semi-finals in large part due to Lech Walesa's goals.
I'm sure you've written a book on him. That was it's one of my poor moments. Don't care on the final question we ask everyone is, if you had written any one of the 5 pieces you submitted to us, which one would it be and why?
I'd probably have to say Roger Angel, to be honest. Just because it speaks to the fan experience so beautifully, you know. And for all that we are interested in drugs in sport and governance issues and, you know, what makes sports people, you know, their faults, their foibles, all that, I think it's actually the pieces that speak to the fan in us that hit me at a gut level. Why not The Silence by Roger Angel?
Kieran, thank you so much for doing the show. I really appreciate it. Yeah, thanks so much to Kieran, and thanks to you for listening and for your support of this show and of the 42 at large. It is greatly appreciated. We are going to be back next week with another great guest, but until then, take it easy.